Well, since the McCarrick scandal and then also the fall of Cardinal Donald Wuerl in his involvement with the Pennsylvania grand jury report, and then all the backlash and outrage in Washington, D.C., leading to his resignation and acceptance by Pope Francis, the new leader in the Catholic Church in America is Blaise Cupich. I'm here today with my co-host, Timothy Gordon, and we're going to take the baseball card of Blaise Cupich, turn it over, look at the back, and look at the stats. Look at the history of who is Blaise Cupich and why is this important? Primarily because he's on the Congregation for Bishops, and he is an opponent of Archbishop Vigano, and Pope Francis has chosen him to head up the Vatican Summit on abuse, on this scandal, which is supposed to be happening in February. So, Timothy Gordon, what do we know about this guy, Blaise Cupich, currently the Cardinal Archbishop of Chicago?
Well, for starters, bear in mind that he is the replacement de facto for Francis Cardinal George of Chicago. And this is a coup for the left in the church, the American Catholic left, insofar as it's like taking Justice Antonin Scalia on the bench and replacing him with a super leftist, a super right wing, super orthodox mover and shaker among Catholic orthodoxy, right? Francis Cardinal George, very, very quotable, whether it's your Fulton Sheen like grabby day to day spoken quotation or your theology grad school paper. Very, very good figure in the church for the Orthodox and the conservatives. So that what all that goes to say is that he, you know, Cupich is a far leftist with a career basically committed to the politics of Pope Francis and of Team Francis, moreover, before Francis was the Pope. And it's a painful thing to watch. Cupich, as his career develops more and more, proves to be one of the shrewder, subtler advocates of the Francis agenda. Because what we were talking about before we started rolling is he's kept his nose clean, unlike the Tobins out there, the McCarricks out there, and this has enabled him to direct a policy agenda from within the cardinalate, the American College of Archbishops and Cardinals, that is more effective, more potent. It's just something to bear in mind as we go through all this.
And I like how you bring back the legacy of Francis George, but it's probably also worth mentioning that going back into the 80s and into the 90s, we had Joseph Bernardin, who you and I have discussed before. He's really the godfather of the seamless garment, false theology. He was, the Don. He was the OG of the leftist anti-John Paul II liberal party in America. And he was really the kingmaker in getting crazy appointments of bishops all over the U.S. And he was from 1982 to 1996. So he had a long reign. And so Francis George being placed into Chicago was sort of seen as a pause, a tapping of the brakes, getting things under control. Now we see with Blaise Cupich that everything's rolling again.
Right, right. Yeah, I guess I made reference to a kind of vacuum, a power shift from right to left. When you go from George to Cupich, I guess it was equal and opposite when we went when they staffed, the Chicago position with Cardinal George from Bernardin. The point, this seems more like a fit when you go from Bernardin to Cupich eventually. So, that is worth pointing out. George had a relatively short tenure, didn't he? I guess I hadn't followed his career closely.
No,
at the
he
time.
Was from 97 to 14. He died of cancer. So he was from 1997 to 2014. So a decent reign.
I guess that's not a blip.
But what's notable is during Bernardin, so many of the priests and the vocations and the seminary formation was formed under Bernardin, which had a lot of homosexuality in it, a lot of liberation theology, a lot of just, you know, moral laxity in that regime. And I don't think Cardinal George was able to overcome that or overstaff that in his presbyterate. So in reality, Blaise Supich has inherited a presbyterate of older priests that are Bernardine priests.
Right.
Who are going to tell you, yeah, you know, we shouldn't, you know, abortion is just one of the life issues. You know, we really need to get on board with immigration and inner city housing and things like that, which, of course, you and I aren't against. They're just not the primary pro-life position.
Sure. Yeah. And also noteworthy before we get rolling here, again, pointing it out for what it's worth, is that Supich was made a bishop by John Paul II. And we've made reference to this before, that JP2 has quite the track record that one would not brag about within the ranks of Orthodoxy in terms of the episcopacy and those that he brought into it. So whatever this is worth, you know, I don't know exactly how intelligible a given, you know, priest's record is prior to being brought into bishop, but it doesn't work out well for JP2, and we've talked about this before.
No, I'd like to talk about a little more, Timothy, because I honestly don't know your mind on this. We've never talked directly about it. The way I was always taught to understand John Paul II, because it's undeniable that he chose horrific bishops in America and all over the world. The Mahonies, you know, we could go on and on. And here we have the Supich, Wuerl, all these guys. So I was always taught.
We have a list somewhere.
Yeah.
We might want to,
We should at some point. But I was always kind of taught in our conservative Catholic circles, John Paul II is a good guy. He's a saint. He has the best intentions for the church. He was going to reform it. But he is Theoden King.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
He's an old man. He's on the throne. And there's this sickness that is set in with Theoden King. I'm talking about Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Right? John Paul II. And there's this dastardly, evil guy named Wormtongue. And Wormtongue is always just feeding lies into his ear. And so Theoden King is making all these horrible decisions about the kingdom, and he's really just degrading the entire kingdom until Gandalf comes in with his staff, basically kind of does this exorcism thing on him. Right.
Right.
And then Theoden King wakes up. But in the case of John Paul II, the story goes, he just kept on getting worse and worse and worse. And all these people around him, Secretary of State, cardinals, prefects, all of them just kept poisoning his mind and saying, appoint that guy and do this. And so down the slope went John Paul II. That has been, up until, well, even now, the majority position on John Paul II.
Yeah.
I mean, is that what you subscribe to? Is that what you've been told all these years?
That's definitely the story. I like your King Theoden analogy. I think in the
book, isn't always Theoden King?
Yeah, it's always Theoden King, the same sense that the medievals always used the name for kind of like, you know,
the title
Francis Cardinal George,
right.
Whatever it is, Francis Cardinal George. Yeah, no, so that's right. So Theoden, if you look at his history in the book, if you go and reread the book, he has this more troubling history than what you get in the movies. And I watch, you know, the movies five times more often than I go back and reread the book. But the last time I was going through, he has a history of self-service and his heroic actions, which eventuate in The Lord of the Rings, specifically Two Towers and Return to the King, are redemptive. You know, they're really a way for him to kind of prove himself. And my mention of this is to further your analogy and to say, JP2, as much as we love him and as much as his intents are often received as nothing but positive, I'm not challenging this, but I do look at the young, you know, life, the young career of JP2, and I'm not gonna refer to him by his last name because I always struggle with how to say it. So pre-pontificate JP2, and it doesn't. The young, fully healthy minded JP2 is. You hear things like he was a wild enthusiast for the council, right? He was not the champion of reform of the reform that his lieutenant, young Ratzinger would become, the champion of the reform of the out of control reforms. The kissing of the Quran, what happened in Assisi in 84, 85, 86. And then, and even this habit that he had by published word to call Vatican II the second Pentecost, right?
Yeah.
With the second birthday of the church, even though it's Council 22 or 23, that doesn't make a lot of sense. And similar to what we distinguished between Ratzinger and JP2 on the Latin Mass and his countenance thereof, he never lost his childish, young man's enthusiasm for the theology and philosophy of Karl Rahner, whereas
right.
Ratzinger did. So so that's kind of the way I view JP2. There's a lot of at best naivete there that is not just a function of
a worm tongue.
A worm tongue. They can't be explained away that way. And maybe at some point we should talk about it more because we're getting people to ask us, hey, red pill on JP2. I just don't know how to do it.
Well, we've been talking about taking the red pill on Pope Francis and these moments in which you realize there's something not right about this pontificate. I can't keep going along with it. There's something wrong here. And you and I have mentioned before that when you take that red pill, and you become a Catholic where you're no longer a cheerleader for whatever the Pope says this week or on an airplane or whatever, right?
Right.
That red pill has a retroactive effect on me as well. Right. I then started thinking of, I really didn't like it when Benedict XVI talked about the UN and that encyclical and how we need the United Nations, and then you start thinking, I really don't like how John Paul basically loaded up the cardinals and the major sees with questionable men. And I really don't like how John Paul saying kiss the Quran. And all of a sudden you start having there's these things in the past that I kind of suppressed and don't think about. But when you started thinking about problems in the current pontificate, then you start thinking about other problems in the pontificate. And so this is like the reverse red pill.
Right.
But anyway, that was all a tangent on John Paul II appointed Blaise Supich as a bishop.
Right.
Yeah.
Which there's plenty of to go around.
Right.
Yeah. Sure.
So that was 1998 in which Blaise Supich became a bishop in the Catholic Church. And isn't what ethnicity is Blaise Supich? Isn't he Croatian?
Yeah, that's got it. That's something Eastern European.
Yeah, I think he's Croatian.
I think that's right.
Because when Croatia was in the World Cup, he was wearing a Croatian jersey. I remember thinking, okay, that's because that Supich, I never could plant that as a, where that comes from. But Croatian, I believe, is Blaise Supich. So he's made a bishop in 98. And one of the things that got him well known in America was in 2002, he barred the doors of the church in one of his parishes that were celebrating the Latin Mass during the Easter Triduum.
Right.
What's up with that? Locking your own people out of their church during Easter?
Yeah, that's strange. Particularly Tridentine Latin Mass from celebrating the Paschal Triduum on Easter or Easter Eve just because it's the 1962, right?
Yeah.
Even if you don't like the old Rite Mass, which obviously this guy doesn't, none of his friends do, none of even the moderates in the church really do. Which is something to remember. It's not just a leftist thing. It's sort of the received mainstream position.
Yes.
Is antipathy toward the Latin Mass, which is staggering. Why borrow trouble? Why pick a fight, right? Particularly, within 5 years of coming in to your seat as bishop, it seems like a strange for a careful measured for a careful and measured leftist bishop in Chicago there. But I can't think of what would motivate this aside from sort of rallying the troops around the cause. You know, why do you think he would do that?
Well, here's the quote. When the local newspaper interviewed him, Bishop Supich said, "I'm looking for one time each year to do that. And it seems the day that the Lord died for us all would be a good day to do it. And that's all there is about it." And then just before that, he talks about an opportunity for unity in the diocese. So I think what he's saying here is, since Jesus died on Good Friday for all of our sins, we should all be united liturgically. So we shouldn't be having a Latin Mass Good Friday service.
Right. When you compare, the interesting thing is when you hear this kind of argument at work against the Tridentine Mass, you know, it's a total false flag. The liturgical unity, it's the opposite of what these leftist guys mean when they say synodality, right? Synodality is basically subsidiarity in the context of items within the life of the church where there probably shouldn't be diversity, right? Diversity, subsidiarity, local choice, where there ought to be unity. And where there ought to be unity, the opposite. So the interesting thing with the rhetoric of synodality and liturgical unity is that unless you really press on, you know, the appropriateness of when you want to have everyone doing the same thing, they can get away with the kind of rhetoric. It's successful.
Yeah. I mean, he basically barred people outside of their going into their church and said, oh, this is just an act of unity.
This is for Easter. Yeah, this is a nice thing to do.
Can I read one of the details here, Tim? It's kind of crazy. Members of the Latin Mass community, which had met in Rapid City for the past 12 years at Immaculate Conception Church on Fifth Street, say Bishop Blaise Supich has barred them from celebrating Good Friday and Easter Vigil services at the church in an attempt to mainstream them into the English language Mass. We've been prohibited by the bishop from celebrating the Easter Triduum liturgies and locked out of our church from noon on Holy Thursday until 8 a.m. on Easter morning.
Mom.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's really extreme.
I mean, Tim, do you think if they were going to have a Kwanzaa liturgy during Christmas, they would have been locked out of their church?
I would hope they should have been. But
I doubt. I doubt it.
Well, coming from a guy like this, no way.
I don't know of any other situation other than just banning Latin Masses in the American church where a bishop just locks people out from Thursday to Sunday.
Right. But this kind of abuse, this is 2002, before Summorum Pontificum,
yes,
before even the pontificate of Benedict the 16th. This is under JP2. Again, not to revisit the tangent we were on before, but this was kind of regular, that sort of thing. Now they're intermittent. They're right. Sprinkled around, you know, the history of the 90s church and the 80s church. But it happened a lot in the 80s and 90s. There was a lot of abuse. When you look at the fact of Summorum Pontificum, where in, is it 06 or 07, Benedict, quote, gave the Latin Mass back to pastors, so they didn't have to seek the permission from their bishop to do the Latin Mass. You know, it's a paraphrasm. It's something that shouldn't have had to have been sought in the first place. So everyone looks at Summorum Pontificum as a historical oddity, right? If we never were without this permiso to celebrate it without the permission specifically of bishops, then why release a document and a somewhat celebrated document from people like us to say this is awesome?
Yeah.
And the answer to the question is a de facto one. It's because in the 80s and 90s church, under the watch of, again, JP2, you had all kinds of crap like this happening, like what Supich did in 2002. That's the short answer without getting into all of them.
Yeah. And to the defense of people who like the Latin Mass, you don't hear it as much, but you still hear it some. And that is, oh, why are Latin Mass people so like disgruntled or mean or whatever? Right now, right. I don't think that that's necessarily true. I think it's a parody, and I think it's a polemic. Most people that I know at Latin Mass are pretty happy and having a good time and shaking hands. And
me too.
You know, it's a pretty normal environment, but there are some kookies, but there's kookies everywhere. There's kookies in the Byzantine rites and there's kookies in the Novus Ordo as well. But
plenty. Yeah.
I think 10 years ago, people were a little bit more disgruntled, especially pre-2007 with Summorum Pontificum. But think about it. For the traditional people who have liked the Latin Mass since for the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s were basically the little brother in the diocese who's been getting slapped around by the bishop.
Right.
Think if you're a family of 10 kids and one of the kids, when he comes home for Easter or Christmas, is locked out of the house over the weekend. What is that kid's attitude towards the family and to the dad?
He's locked in the house. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Like I'm thinking Home Alone. Every time I watch, it's getting deep in here. Like time I watch Home Alone, which we watched over Thanksgiving, it's like, yeah, this kid's bratty, but man, he's really mistreated by his family. Like I understand why he's disgruntled. Yeah, yeah. This is the Latin Mass churchgoer. I didn't mean to cut you off, but he's
Kevin.
Kevin McAllister.
Yeah, he's Kevin.
He is. Your family sucks.
Yeah,
you know? His uncle calls him a jerk, and everyone just watches, and no one's like, "Whoa, you can't call an 8-year-old." Hey, Kevin's 8.
Yeah.
So this was the, and I went to Latin Mass before, slightly before Summorum Pontificum is when I began going. It was actually I think earlier that year, and it just happened to be released that summer. It was the summer before I went to Rome. And you look, I've seen a timeline of this in the pontificate of JP2. Again, that's not the subject of the video, but what do you want? I mean, even the likes of great thinkers in the church who are newer to the Latin Mass than you or I, I'm thinking like our good friend Pat Coffin, you know, who we just talked about. Even the sort of measured response of Pat Coffin, which is always, I love the Latin Mass. He's totally has nothing bad to say about it. As you pointed out, sometimes it's always peppered with and with the cautionary caveat of, but you know, some of those people are whatever. And I'm like, I don't know. I get the bitterness. I guess I just get the bitterness a little bit more.
First off, I think since Summorum, the bitterness has gone away a lot. But when we say, why are these people so bitter? Well, think about if you were locked out of your church for the highest feast day of the year because the bishop says, I want to promote unity. Give me a break.
Right.
So.
Well, it also makes me bitter when I'm at a local parish and they say you're not allowed to receive communion on the mouth because it's cold and flu season.
Yeah.
You know, it's clearly a false flag.
Precisely.
It's clearly you're being given a line. So yeah, that makes you a little bit bitter. Bitter. I mean, a lot of the great saints were bitter. So I you know, that's that. But yeah, Supich was fully on board for this
when you're
scheme.
When you're locked home alone over the Latin Mass.
You get mad, and you're trying to keep these two villains out of your home.
Exactly. Yeah. The wet bandits. The wet bandits.
The wet bandits. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So more on Supich. So another zinger. So he locks Latin masters out of their church on Easter in 2004. He basically comes out and says, "Look, we should not deny communion for politicians who openly support abortion rights." Here's his quote, Timothy. Blaise Supich, quote, "We cannot cherry pick particular issues. We have to be willing to talk about all issues. Our position begins with protecting the unborn, but it doesn't end there," end quote. This was really him going to town for Barack Obama in Chicago.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry, he's not in Chicago yet. My bad. Barack is from Chicago, but he's still in Rapid Cities at this point.
Right, but it's 2004.
It's clearly Supich campaigning for a bigger and better C.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. That's right. I mean, and again, it serves well to look at the rhetoric some. Nothing he said here is theoretically wrong to not be able to, you know, we're not supposed to cherry pick particular issues. We're not. What do we call that? We call that cafeteria Catholicism. So this has the ring of truth. We have to be willing to talk about all issues. Great. Yeah, we shouldn't just talk about abortion. Let's also talk about the mortal sinfulness of homosexuality. Right, Blaze? You know, I'm down for that. Let's also talk about, you know, euthanasia. Let's talk about all the serious, grave, moral issues. But that's not what he means. What he means, it's bi-language. There's a wink and a nod here. It means we don't want to, because when you make this claim, let's not cherry pick. You could either be saying, let's talk about more issues universally, or let's talk about less issues universally. That's the byplay.
Yeah.
That's what he really means.
Good point.
Our position begins with protecting the unborn, but it doesn't end there. It's like, again, we could talk, let's not just talk about the unborn the way Francis said, you know, 3 weeks into his pontificate. Let's talk about other issues if we're going to insist on talking about the unborn. So he's like, let's just talk about none of the uncomfortable issues.
Yeah.
It's serious trouble.
Yeah. And then also to the help of Barack Obama, 2008, he has that quote. You want to read that one, Timothy? Where he kind of goes up to bat for Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Do you have that one?
Yeah, I do. As we draw near an election day on which one of the major party candidates for president is for the first time a person of African-American ancestry, we should be able to do so with a sense that whatever the outcome, America has crossed another threshold in healing the wounds that racism has inflicted on our nation's body politic for an entire history. However, in view of recent media reports regarding race-based voting, the potentially healing moment could turn into the infliction of one more wound if racism appears to determine the outcome. Because of that menacing possibility, it is worth recalling for Catholics and Americans, and all Americans, racism is a sin. Now, the irony
This is basically a political statement. We need to vote for Barack Obama or we're being racist.
It's basically a stump speech. The irony is, if you apply the rigor of his logic in a more accurate way than how he facially intends it, you would say, okay, yeah, well, I forget what portion share of Black Americans voted for Obama. It was 97%, I believe, 96 or 97%. That is, you know, prima facie evidence of at least what a court would call disparate impact. I mean, that's basically the first step toward racism, and you'd have to show that, you know, race is the motive that it ostensibly seems to be. Which I think is pretty much a slam dunk. So I agree with what he's saying. I mean, racism isn't just something that only white people are capable of. So if you apply the rigor of what he's saying, it's actually correct, just in the opposite way in regard to how he intended it.
Right. And wild. even, you know, I don't want to get onto Barack Obama in America, but, you know, even if you want to say white people voting for Barack Obama, to have to prove that they are not racist.
Yeah,
is ridiculous. We should be voting on candidates based on their morality, their history, their voting record, and their positions.
The content of their character, as
exactly.
I guess the left at one time believed, not the
precisely,
color of the skin.
Precisely. So, you know, we had probably the most pro-abortion presidency for 8 years, thanks to Obama and thanks to Supich, who was doing stumps. Speeches for him.
Well, Obama, real quick, because there's something that happened in 2006 regarding abortion as well. Same year, I believe, there was something called the Born Alive Act put up to the United States Senate. I think it was one of the first major policies that Obama voted for or against. 99 of the 100 U.S. senators, most of whom are what we would consider you know, center left by an Orthodox Catholic standard, even most of the Republicans voted down. I'm forgetting whether or not the Born Alive Act was, or voted for it. The one vote against was young Barack Obama. And what the Born Alive Act said is that if an abortion fails, you can't throw away the body and essentially let the young baby die as medical refuse. The one, so this just right. evidences what you just claimed about the most pro-abortion mainstream politician the United States has ever produced. Murderous. This is a murderous policy. And this thug from Chicago IL, full of this Saul Alinsky, you know, Chicago IL politics and all the rest, openly voted as one of his first acts against the idea that it's illegal to kill a baby who has been born after an attempted abortion. And this made major news, right? This made major news. So maybe it hadn't yet happened, though I thought it was 2006 as well. People should look that up. But anyway, in 2006, South Dakota voters are considering a referendum that would ban abortion, except in the case of saving the mother's life. So you'd have the principle of double effect. Right. Not that the average
This is
while
Supich is in South Dakota, by the way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. He calls for public dialogue marked by civility and clarity. And that again, facially doesn't sound bad. What he's really proposing are three conditions for the conduct of the political debate. The conditions are, one, it must be recognized that both the issue of abortion and legal restrictions on abortion are inevitably moral questions informed by moral values. Fine. Number two, there should be agreement that any discussion of abortion and the law must recognize both the suffering of the unborn children in abortion and the suffering of pregnant women in dire circumstances. Until the last probably nine words, and that's where you get all of the loaded, strong pro-abortion rhetoric. And number three, there must be a commitment to dialogue. Again, there's the hoary language,
right,
that is civil, interactive, and substantial. This statute ended up being defeated 55 to 45. Now, again, people might look at that and say, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that, Dr. Marshall?
Well, I mean, if you bring in the condition of the suffering of the pregnant woman right with the suffering of the unborn child, you now have two escape clauses in this moral situation, right? So you can say, and it opens the crack for Satan to put his toe in there, and then his foot, and then his leg, and then his body, and then his head, and he's in the room. This is how the abortion agenda has been driven since the early 1900s.
Right.
I mean, that's it. I don't know what else to say about it. And what's sad is we have a Catholic bishop basically opening the door just enough for a toe of the devil to get in.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's bad stuff that you got. Again, there aren't that many, we should point this out about Supich. There aren't that many American bishops. You know, it's different when you talk about Cardinal Gottfried Daniels and some of the Northern European archbishops and cardinals that more openly would say things like this that are basically pro-abortion, sound like the rhetoric of a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama. Supich is one of the only American ones. A lot of them, I think, are privately pro-abortion and are against the censoring of pro-abortion politicians because they're scratching their backs. People like Pelosi or Joe Biden, who are also in name Catholic. So, but that's the most you'll ever hear from most of the leftist American Catholic prelates. Supich, in a couple instances here, was more out there on the pro-abortion limb than almost any other American Catholic bishop I've ever heard of.
Precisely.
Maybe Bernadine.
Not so much by his words, but whirl by his behavior in D.C. during this era. And it's not odd at all to see Supich out in Rapid City, out in the sticks, but he is saying the things that Wuerl is doing. And it's not at all odd that here we are 10 years later and we see that Wuerl and Supich have emerged together as consuls in the Catholic Church in America. And both of them are the only cardinals currently on the Congregation for Bishops. They are the kingmakers. I also want to state here, it is obvious to me as we look through the things we're reading here and discussing, the young Blaise Supich is campaigning for bigger and better things in the church in America.
Right.
He has put his flag up early on. He has licked his finger, put it up, and he saw which way the wind is blowing in the Catholic Church. And he went out big. He went big. Banning the Latin Mass, stump speeches for Obama, you know, and then we see it was in when he goes to Spokane, he gets transferred in 2010 by Pope Benedict XVI. Thank you, Benedict XVI, for that. He bans priests from participating in rosary campaigns outside Planned Parenthood, and he bans 40 days for life in his diocese. So he is definitely letting the world know, look, I am soft on abortion. I am pro-Democrat Party. I am anti-Latin Mass. I want all my people to know that, and I want my brother bishops to know I'm that guy. And it paid off well, because guess who's his best, his BFF right now? Pope Francis.
Right.
Everything Pope Francis is doing has anything to do with America. Supich is the point man. He's the Donald Wuerl 2.0.
Right. Cleaner record, Donald Wuerl.
Donald Wuerl?
Donald Wuerl.
Okay. I thought you said Donna. Yeah, my bad.
You could call him Donna. If you want. That's not his name, but you know, people like that. Maybe you like that. But the point is, yeah, young Supich is careful. Well, I mean, to some extent he's careful. The thing about inter-Catholicism leftism is it's simultaneously bold, right? I'm always correcting people when they say, these people are cowards. You know, they're not cowards. There's a boldness here, because if you just follow me through this thought experiment for a second. Let's say that Roman Catholicism is not the one true faith. It's not the one true worldview, the one true ideology. Let's say it's something else. Let's call it X. If you are a high-ranking leader of X worldview, and you are a committed opponent of all of the essential properties of X, then you're either going to be a secret sort of double agent, you know, the way that these infiltrators were in the Catholic Church for 50 years. Or you would think, okay, I'm going to be true to what I believe, but, you know, I guess I'm going to be kicked out of worldview X because I started espousing, you know, the X prime point of view, the opposite of X. Somehow guys like Supich, and I mean, we've covered this a lot, have committed themselves to being cautiously open about articulating their unacceptable point of view, their anti-Catholic point of view. And at the same time, you know, guys like Wuerl have done so in a sufficiently articulate way, such as to, they're kind of hiding in plain sight. And, you know, when I think of someone like Supich, he's been a lot more effective just doing this, you know, moderate amount of research for today's show, then guys like Tobin, which we talked about some, then guys like Wuerl or McCarrick, and you know, these are the other three
Mahoney.
Or four.
Yeah.
Mahoney. He was incautious. Right. I mean, he made mistakes, got caught. Even your average sort of know nothing Catholic in the pew, at least out here where I'm at in California, is known to make fun of Mahoney. We have all kinds of rhyming names for him out here. And this goes back to, you know, 10, 15 years ago, people knew Mahoney was bad. It's not the same way with a Supich until recently through his close pairing with Francis. But the point is he's been a really effective sort of double agent, or whatever you call someone that operates within the Catholic Church for global leftism.
Right. Well, now we call it Team Francis.
Team Francis. Yeah.
But before this, we didn't really have, it was covert. It was St. Gallen Mafia. It was, you know, little groups here and groups of bishops here. But now it's out in the open and everybody's waking up.
Right. So how does all this shake out when we consider what's to happen in February of 2019? Why Supich? Why now? It seems like a little bit too much too quick.
Well, there's three more episodes in Supich's career I want to cover, and then we'll hit that question. Because everybody wants to know, why is Supich the point guy in the global solution to McCarrick and the scandals? Let's just say that. We're going to get to it. Supich is the number one guy under Pope Francis to solve the global problem, which was sparked by the revelations of ex-Cardinal McCarrick, who, by the way, helped get Supich appointed.
Right.
But a few more things. One, Supich wrote a book in 2011 called The New Roman Missal, A Time of Renewal.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, we got to get, he explicitly says, no more ad orientem, as the church has always done it. That is the priest facing the crucifix, the tabernacle, in favor of versus populum. He lamented those who did not accept the Novus Ordo. And he wrote favorably on the vernacular, non-Western enculturation of the liturgy, and more lay participation, which doesn't mean prayer like it did historically. It means getting up and doing stuff around the sanctuary.
Dancing.
Dancing. Yeah.
Moving about.
Yeah. Administering Holy Communion, etc. Now, the other one is his pastoral letter, in which he speaks of same-sex marriage in Washington State as a matter of equality.
Right.
This happened in the 2012 referendum in Washington State.
Right.
And I'll read the quote. He says, proponents of the redefinition of marriage are often motivated by compassion for those who have shown courage in refusing to live in the fear of being rejected for their sexual orientation. It is a compassion that is very personal for those who have suffered and continue to suffer, are close and beloved friends and family members. It is also a compassion forged in reaction to tragic national stories of violence against homosexuals, of verbal attacks that demean their human dignity, and of suicides by teens who have struggled with their sexual identity or have been bullied because of it. As a result, supporters of the referendum often speak passionately of the need to rebalance the scales of justice. It's a stump speech.
It is. It's a development of, there's this organic continuity between the kind of crypto pro-abortion that we were hearing circa 2006, 2008, and the crypto pro-homosexualist rhetoric, right? There's always that connection. And now it's like, you see he's kind of moved on. He's flying the flag early with very careful language even as it's careful, it just shouldn't be there about abortion. 6 to 10 years later, then the rhetoric all shifts to what guys like us suspect is the real end game, which is similar kind of careful but inappropriate language about why are you saying this about what's your skin in the game here? Hopefully that's just an expression, but what's your skin in the game here? Why is this? Sure, it's a secular voting matter in a liberal state, but why do you need to weigh in on this?
Yeah, and weigh in with the language of the scales of justice. Rebalance the scales of justice. That's saying that the scale of justice are not balanced. He's basically saying we have an injustice. If the scales, that's why in America and in Western tradition, the scales represent justice. Give each their due, as we've talked about in so many of our video podcasts. Supich is saying they're not. So we got to rebalance it. And he's basically saying we do that by allowing same-sex marriage. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous.
It's an explicit endorsement of same-sex marriage when you do the math that a lot of people read that quote and don't do. Yeah, yes. If they're imbalanced, it means the only way to get them back balanced is to let gay people pretend they're married.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So then he goes to Chicago. I mean, the big news, and he becomes a cardinal. under Pope Francis. The big news for him is he said, you know, people don't like Pope Francis because he's a Latino. That was one of his big quotes. Another one of his quotes was when he stated that there's a bigger agenda in the church right now, like climate change and immigration, than the sexual abuse crisis. That was another famous Supich zinger. And then the other big one is when he basically locked the priest burn the gay pride rainbow flag that was hanging in the sanctuary of the church. And he was locked out of his home and basically went into exile under Supich. So it seems like almost everything controversial about Supich has to do with abortion, same-sex issues, and liturgy. And I want people to just take a moment, because not everybody's red-pilled yet on the constellation of those issues together.
Mm-hmm.
The liturgy is a very important piece of propaganda in these issues. Not that the Novus Ordo per se is bad, invalid, whatever, but it allows the priest to modify the liturgy, to choose the Eucharistic canon, and to insert things as he desires, as he wants. And that ability for the priest to modify and change the liturgy Sunday after Sunday allows him to introduce all kinds of novelties and his own thoughts and ideas. I mean, you go to the Latin Mass, there's no opportunity besides the sermon for the priest to interject anything.
That's true. A couple other things. One, the ad orientem posture during the consecration of the priest is, I maintain, the most important aspect of reforming the reform. I think it's even more important than the Latin language itself, more important than other dimensions that we can bandy about. It is the key posture, I think. And he mentioned it specifically. I was going to react to that 3 or 4 minutes ago when you read it. So that's one thing. Not only is he an opponent of restoring the Latin Mass, obviously, but he's a specific line item opponent of what I take to be the most important dimension of the Latin Mass,
which is the Ad Orientem.
Ad Orientem versus,
and notably, the Second Vatican Council did not ban Ad Orientem.
Well, it makes a kind of laudatory reference to it in Sacrosanctum Concilium, the sacred constitution on the liturgy from which allegedly the new Mass was written,
right,
as a template. It basically makes a passing reference to Ad Orientem posture as what ought to continue.
And in the 19,
I don't have it.
In the 1970 Missal, the Latin rubrics presume Ad Orientem. For example, it'll say the priest turns around and says to the people,
right,
well, why is he turning around if he's already facing everyone?
Yeah, exactly.
So we've been lied to. We've been ripped off. We have these people like Supich who are telling us, oh, the council fathers taught versus populum. We all need to do it. We need to wreck our cathedrals. We need to put in these IKEA altars outside the sanctuary in the transept. And the priest has to face the people. It's a lie. It's wrong. It's of the devil.
Right.
You don't go and, like we said, I don't know what video it is, but it's like my wife sets everything up for Thanksgiving. Beautiful. Does all this work, or for Christmas. And then I come in the front door with a folding table from IKEA, a modern table. I'm like, no, we're going to do it over here with the plastic cups.
And a neon St. Pauli girl sign. I want to put this up.
Yeah. And a leg lamp. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. A leg lamp. She's like, this isn't quite the aesthetic I was going for. You're like, yeah. I think it was.
But Catholics, you know, they spent, 500 years building this Baroque cathedral with an incredible Baroque altar that's all integrated and with symmetry. And then they bring in these 1979 IKEA tables.
Yeah.
It's offensive.
And now that formal aesthetic is nothing but Baroque. It's Baroque.
It's Baroque in. Baroque, yeah. So I think those are all the points I wanted to hit on Supich,
Yeah, a second thing. One quick response to that last Supich point about Francis is unpopular because he's a Latino. This is like when your critics out there, your Dr. Taylor Marshall critics say, I don't like him because he's Black.
I know.
Which
I'm offended by that.
Right. He's so people. Our Holy Father is not Latino, right? He was he's Italian. Both his mother and his father are immigrated Italians. So
yeah,
that's fine to want to defend your homie, your boy, but get it right. You know, I'm like, yeah, you know, I if I were to defend Dr. Taylor Marshall to one of his critics, I would say, well, race has nothing to do with it, of course.
Right.
He'd be a good guy, whether he's black, white, yellow, pink, yeah, whatever. But I wouldn't say, oh, you just dislike him because he's black. You hate him on account of his blackness, people.
So we see with Obama and in the elections, and then this comment by George, George realizes the power of race baiting, and he will do it, even if it's lie.
Supich.
I said Blaze, didn't I?
You said Blaise, George.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I said George. Blaze.
We're thinking. Correction. We're thinking the good cardinal.
Yeah. Blaze Supich knows the power of race baiting, and he will do it. And he'll say, well, Pope Francis is a Latino. No, he speaks Spanish, but he's ethnically Italian. It'd be like saying, well, you know, Marcel Lefebvre was an archbishop in Africa. So it'd be like, people don't like him in his society. Black. No, because he's African.
Yeah.
Well, he was an archbishop in Africa, but he's not. Anyway, people get the point. Okay, well, so let's talk about his role.
Sure.
No, you were going to say something. Sorry.
Final thought. Supich, of course he knows the power of race baiting because he's an American leftist, right?
Right.
American leftists know this, wield it, implement it, and have really leveraged it effectually better than any other of the global worldwide leftists. American leftists know it and use it. It is their mark, almost their indelible watermark. They use a lot of the same other tricks that worldwide leftists do, but Americans, because we had slavery, segregation, all the rest of it, it's the mark of the American leftist. It's a special ode to global leftism. So just wanted to point that out.
Yeah, good point. All right, so that brings us to the topic. We looked at the back of the baseball card of Supich, looked at his stats, look where he's been, look what he's accomplished. And now we see that the general manager, Pope Francis, has drafted him to be the point man of the February meeting organized in Rome on clerical sexual abuse.
Yeah.
Supich has said that Vigano can't be trusted, that the McCarrick abuse cover-up is a rabbit hole that we don't need to go down. So we know already that Pope Francis has chosen Supich, and the agenda in February will be that articulated already by Supich. Francis has said not one word, kind of. You know, he's talked about the great accuser. But Supich, back here in America, has been very wordy and verbose about how everything stands. And it's Vigano is wrong, can't be trusted. It's a rabbit hole. It's not that big of a deal. We need to move on in the church for the sake of unity. And I guarantee you, Timothy, that's what it's going to be all about in February. We got to protect God's children and move on for the sake of unity.
Of course.
Mercy. And they're all going to pat each other on the back and come home and expect all of us to believe that.
Right. Right. Supich also led the charge at the recent meeting against the vote.
Good point.
I think we can't let that go. I think he was the head cheerleader of the strike down of letting lay investigate their crooked bishops, their you know,
that's right,
pederast bishop.
And well, when Cardinal DiNardo read the statement saying Pope Francis has asked us not to move forward and not to vote, Supich stood up and issued a clarification. And it looks, from an outsider's point of view, that Supich was briefed beforehand by Pope Francis. Hey, here's the letter. It's going to be read. When it's read, before any uproar breaks out on the floor of the bishops, I want you to stand up and explain it as my point man. He's the altar boy of Pope Francis, Supich.
Right. Yeah. Right. This. Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. That's wild. I mean, already there's, we talk about every day, the constant barrage of outrageous, you know, one-liners and facts that we're less callous than the average Catholic in the pew, of course. But even a guy like us, think about it. I'm already forgetting the outrage that was just perpetrated on the American Catholic not 2 weeks ago, yeah, by the voting down of further investigation into Cardinal McCarrick and the voting down of lay involvement in this. It is, I mean, these people are up there representing their own interests, and it's naked, no pun intended. It's naked, yes, self-serving. It is naked self-service. And as is having, you know, Francis cheerleader Blaise Cupich and homosexualist, homosexual agenda pusher Blaise Cupich running the meeting in February. This is the last person that should be doing it. And they pass it in front of us, and it's not even much of a Trojan horse. It makes me sick. It makes me ashamed.
Why? I'm just thinking from like a meta narrative point of view, why is it that Catholics just don't care that much? They know it. I mean, these bishops, archbishop, cardinals have been in the business long enough,
right,
to know that you can pull things off like locking people out of church over the Triduum of Easter. It ticks people off. But, you know, 3 or 4 years later, no one knows about it. There's just a couple guys on YouTube talking about it. But for the most part, they get away with it time after time after time after time. What is it in the Catholic mentality that just lets it go?
This is an important question, and it's maybe worth doing a whole separate video on. There seems to be a strange, I think the answer lies in refining the parameters a bit. I think the question is, what is it about the Catholic American mentality that enables such diminution of all things truly Catholic and all things truly good? And here, I'm not even talking about the Cupiches or the Nancy Pelosi's, the leftist Catholics. I'm talking about center and center right American Catholics.
Yes.
We're the ones standing for these kinds of abuses, which is what we've been talking about the last couple minutes. I argue that there's a weird overlap when you come to, because I actually live in one of the few politically conservative areas in California, right? There's a weird overlap between, in America, which is a Puritan place originally, between political right-wing ideology, you know, political conservatism, and theological conservatism. There seems to be some waspish backlash, and I can't put my finger on exactly what it is, but teaching in this area, I'm teaching to mostly, you know, the offspring of politically conservative parents, right? And so I never, ever, ever get in trouble for around elections. You know, I don't dumb things down too much. But I do occasionally get in, not in trouble, but I do occasionally get furrowed brows and concerned questions about things like the Latin Mass, even from political conservatives.
Yes.
So political and theological conservatism share some overlap, a fair amount of overlap, but it's misleading for our viewers out there to assume that it's more overlap than it is. There's a certain American conservatism seems to carry forward with it a waspishness that has, for whatever reasons, I kind of deal with this in my book, but it has, for whatever reasons, a kind of waspy Puritan form of right-wingishness, which is some of which is bona fide true right-wingism. But a lot of conservatives that do go to get up, roll out of bed and go to mass on Sunday mornings are the ones that are like, hey man, I mean, I'm fine with hearing this mass in my own language, maybe hearing it in Latin to a lot of kind of blue collar conservatives or even just brass tacks, white collar conservatives. They're like, this is kind of Euro, you know, which they distrust. This is in a different language. Americans are, of all the first world nations, no offense, guys, the worst at language. You know, the Americans make it like it's really hard to learn other languages. It's really not. So there's some aspect of this that, you know, maybe just the Latin they don't like. A lot of conservatives take a facially lame approach to things like anything new, you know, and to them, if you've been, you know, baptized or confirmed after 1970, the new thing is the old thing. New, you know, new Coke is really old Coke from your perspective. And if they're kind of either brass tacks, white collar guys, or just you're kind of, you know, Bob Swirsky, Ditka loving super fan, you know, blue collar guy from Pittsburgh, they're not interested in enough, you know, whether it's a dentist or a plumber or whatever, and they're good conservative boys that I like otherwise. They're not interested in the truth of the Latin Mass, the liturgy, enough to be like, oh, we do need to be learning a little bit of Latin. We do need to be saying the Mass in Latin. The priest does need to be. Why doesn't he face me? Right. Yeah. I like that. You'll hear a lot of, like, even conservative political people say, I don't want to change that. Why would he? I can't hear him when he faces away. It's not about hearing him. It's about him praying.
I always say he's not talking to you.
He's not talking to you.
He's talking to God. Yeah. You kind of put your finger on the waspishness of it, and it might be that the conservative GOP mentality is very much rooted, like we see it in Texas, of, you know, thank God I'm a country boy, country music, pickup trucks, we're all equal when we stand before the American flag, that kind of idea. And so there is an unusual kind of egalitarianism in hardcore Southern patriotism. Everybody's at the NASCAR race. Everybody's praying, right? We're all together. You know, right. if you, for the prayer at the NASCAR race, if you brought out a guy in a fiddleback chasuble and a Beretta, they wouldn't be about that. So I think there's something there, because the Latin Mass screams hierarchy. It screams, this guy is in persona Christi. And so in that sense, it is sort of old world, Euro, hierarchical, et cetera. So that's probably the resistance to it.
Yes.
And there's a way, and if you're really into the traditional, interestingly enough, most of the hardcore traditional type people I know aren't hardcore GOP Republican. They actually tend a little bit more towards the libertarian. They're kind of like coming full circle and like touching some liberal issues.
Right.
That's just an observation, not necessarily true all the way.
Yeah, no, don't mention like Austrian economics. They'll go off about that, but they do have a libertarian streak. Yeah, as do I. A kind of conservatarian streak. I don't criticize it. Yeah, what the term is, and again, that we're kind of dancing around, is American Whiggishness, right? American was formed, the founders called themselves neo-Whigs.
Yeah.
Whiggism is bound up in 17th century English politics it's the hardcore Protestant resistors of hierarchy and the pretender Stuart King. So you and I talked about it the first time I ever spoke to you on camera about my book. It's Whiggishness is that American puritanical, all conservatives that are decently but maybe not superlatively educated in political discourse will have it, whether they're Catholic or Protestant. They'll have a leaning towards Whiggishness, which makes them have some of these Protestant favoring presuppositions unless they've specifically disabused themselves of them.
Yeah. And we saw that in American Catholicism, kind of like at the height of John Paul II. And I'm thinking in my mind, like George Weigel.
Yes.
George Weigel is that neocon, theocon, the first things. It's the Whiggish conservative Catholicism.
Yes.
Rick Santorum, that whole orbit there that was happening 2000s. And I think Pope Francis has pushed people to sort of regather and reconnect. And you're starting to see people who are moving back in time and saying, hey, I don't know what the answers are, but, you know, the way they did seminary before, the way they did liturgy before, the way they did cardinals before, or the way they canonized saints before seemed better than what we got now. So we need to reinvestigate that. And the dust has definitely not settled. But you do see, and I think you and I are critical of this in some of our very first videos, that the people who are most attracted to, say, the Latin Mass are also into these fairy tales of we've got to restore the monarchy.
Integralism. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, honestly, I've been thinking more about that. We should do a video on it. I think when it comes to integralism, you and I are that way. we just don't necessarily see it as being monarchy per se. Whereas yes. they're all in on monarchy. And we've talked a lot about that in previous videos. Check the YouTube channel.
Right. Yeah.
But we're just kind of looking at a bird's eye view here. Because there is the idea of hierarchy in structure and sacred persons. All that lends itself to kings, monarchy, aristocracy, right. nobles. So could you have both? I think you could. I think you and I both believe that you could have a republic that is Catholic, that is Christian. You could even have an aristocracy in that republic, of course. But you don't right. necessarily have to have 13th century France.
Right. What you couldn't have is a Catholic democracy, right? But it would be very easy in you know, Montesquieu in terms to get a republic that, mm-hmm. that fully is, you know, honors Christianity in a way that would be on par with,
right.
you know, where you could, because I mean, you're just like, look, let's make a Catholic republic, right? Mm-hmm. Republics are built on not pluralism, right?
Yeah.
So these ideas of pluralism, largeness of country, a large republic is a contradiction in terms, according to pretty much all the classical Republican theorists. You get that, again, WASPy Whiggishness in the early states. And it's a bunch of sort of Protestant founders and framers that wanted to try something new, a large republic that allows in pluralism, mainly for at least a plural point of view of Protestant sects. And that doesn't work. Well, a republic for with the implications that you pretty much articulated before, you could have a Catholic republic. It's just supposed to be a bunch of like-minded dudes, guys that are, they don't necessarily have to agree as much as you and I, but something close to that, where you're just like, yeah, hell yeah, I would live in a small republic with this guy, like almost like a neighborhood of like-minded individuals.
Yeah, a polis.
Yeah, a polis. That's what a republic is supposed to be. So yeah, so I agree with all that.
So anyway, we should do a show on that. We should do some kind of talk on the relationship between liturgy, political outlook, organization, the past, the future. But I think we should clean up here with soupage before we...
How do you do that?
Well, yeah,
I'm joking.
It raises the question for all of us who are following this, for all of us, all of those people out there that are Marshall and Gordon fans who are following this very closely, and they know the players, you know, they know McCarrick, they know Vigano, they know Whirl, they know Supich, they know Big Tobin in Newark. That's another, you know, some people said, well, it looked like Tobin when Whirl was heading towards retirement age, which is 75, it looked like Big Tobin. There's two Tobins. There's one in Rhode Island. There's one in Newark. The Cardinal is Big Tobin. I call him Big Tobin because he's big.
Son of Thunder. Yeah.
Big Tobin, he was in Newark, which was McCarrick's see. It's a natural trend. It's sort of a junior version of New York City Archbishop. He was made a cardinal. It seemed very natural for him to slide down into Washington, D.C. and be the cardinal of D.C. He has all the same theological and political beliefs as Donald Whirl. But he had that unfortunate event where he meant to send a text. And he sent out the tweet, night, night, baby, I love you. And everyone said, who are you tweeting, night, night, baby, I love you? Aren't you a his celibate sister. Clerical? And he said it was his little sister.
Everyone talks that way to their sister. Come on.
I don't.
You're being paranoid.
I know. No. And everyone's scratching their head, night, night, baby,
pretty weird, I love baby. You.
And then the other one that came out just a week or so ago is there's all these rumors that he had this Italian male model living in the rectory with him.
Right.
And then he was asked, who was it that asked him? It wasn't Michael Voris. It was Neumeier.
No, Neumeier. Yeah, George
Neumeier at the USCCB put a mic in his face and said, hey, do you have this male model with all these pictures up on the internet and on Instagram living in your rectory? And he said, yes. Or not, he did, but not right now. He was living there. So everyone was thinking, why does a cardinal who tweets out night, night, baby have a male model living in his rectory? And he said because he was taking language classes at the Catholic University.
Duh. You're so paranoid. Yeah. And he brought in the male model to take language classes and to date his little sister so that he would no longer have to be the one to say, night, night, baby.
Yeah.
It all checks out.
It's sketchy. It's sketchy. So because of that, Tobin has sort of been downgraded a notch. There's too much liability with Tobin. Male models, careful. And he's not careful. Can you imagine Pope Francis saying, hey, I was going to put you in D.C., but I just found out you had a male model in the rectory. Salute you on that, but that looks sketchy. Even we can't handle that.
And you're saying nighty night, baby, I love you, getting on planes to this male model, likely. And you're really bad at tweeting. Yeah. I mean, was he trying? Yeah. I'm not.
It's one of those things where you open the wrong app. You know, you think you're opening your messaging app, your tweet. I mean, your texting, and then but you're tired, so you opened up Twitter and you sent it to 20,000 people. And immediately he deleted it.
It's lovely.
He deleted it. People already screen captured it. So it was out there.
Yeah. So, I'm always doing that.
Yeah. So he has been notched down a bit, Tobin, and they need a replacement for Wuerl, either in DC or just a figurehead.
Yeah.
I've heard that Supich could take DC, or more likely that Pope Francis is going to cherry pick Supich out of America and place him in a role in Rome. We saw Pope Benedict do this with Cardinal Burke. Things were hitting the fan in America. If you have a favorite cardinal in America and you don't want scandal to tar him, you bring him to Rome. So he has no priests, no lay people. He has nobody make any accusations or problems. He's just in an office in Rome. So he's safe. So if Supich is going to play that role, he could be moved to Rome. Or if Francis can't get someone solid in D.C., he leaves Supich in Chicago. If he doesn't put him in D.C., and he continues to rely on Supich in Chicago to be his eyes and his ears, his policeman in America. Yeah. And then he just flies Supich over every month or every 2 months and has a meeting with the Pope and says, here's what's going on in America. Or these dioceses are open. You should put these guys in these places.
Yep.
So
Sounds like a working game plan.
Yep.
I mean, like, look, it's not, we're talking about Republican politics, small r. We don't have a voice. I mean, Pope Francis is moving the chess pieces at will. He's playing chess against himself here. We can't do anything. I mean, like I said, there's an impotence on this, our side. And I mean, that one that's faultless. We really, even when we're yelling about it and getting on the sticks, you say it, your audience, you know, Church Militant's audience, George Neumeier's audience is like, yeah, we're mad. And that this is what I'm always saying to do. People should be mad and speak in a loud voice and dump over a trash can or two, proverbially. But what else can you do? I mean, Francis now, remember, the agenda has come out into the daylight. Ever since Amoris Laetitia, in an increasingly emergent way. And now it's like he's no longer trying to pretend. And he's like, again, this is best instantiated by what happened with the McCarrick thing, where he's like, I'm not going to defend myself. I'm not going to say one word. Yeah. I want you, the worldwide press, to go out there and do what you can to defend me. And there's an impotence on our side that should be articulated here, you know, like,
yeah.
We all know Supich is just a cheerleader for globalism and leftism, and Francis can more freely move about. I'd imagine it's a liberating thing to come out the way he has over the last 2.5 years and just say, yeah, these are my boys. I'm going to move them about, you know, when they get openly out of line in a way that I'm not yet comfortable with, like a Tobin. Big Tobin, as you call them, then they won't be promoted openly. But as long as they're semi cautious, like a Supich, he's perfect. You're going to see him continue to advance through the ranks.
Yeah, we don't have one whiff of compromise, moral compromise with Supich, like we did with Wuerl, or we did with McCarrick, or we do with Tobin.
Personal moral compromise. Yeah,
precisely.
In the private life.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no rumor that there's a male model at Supich's residence. Right. So in that sense, he's played his cards right. Before we sign off, there's one more interesting element that you and I didn't discuss previously, but at the summit, not only is Supich a point man, but also we've seen this Archbishop Shikluna, yeah, Maltese from Malta. He's become more and more prominent in Rome.
Yes.
Pope Francis has been tapping him, and he's also going to be a lead guy at the February summit. And Shikluna is the number one guy. He came out saying, hey, Amoris Laetitia teaches communion for divorce, remarriage, rah, rah, rah. So yes. He's been one of the leaders on interpreting Amoris Laetitia in the leftist, I don't know, what do you call it? What's the interpretation? What do we call it? That basically says, yes, what everybody thinks it says, it's what it says.
Yeah, yeah. I call it the correct interpretation, right. You know, that gets me in trouble with other conservatives. Like, this isn't, he didn't say which sacrament it is. Well, he said the five sacraments it's not, indicating it's now open to the civilly divorced or remarried, and it's not right. One of the five besides.
Yeah, he's not talking about confirmation.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, Kaluna also wasn't he the lean back and smile guy? Like
he
that?
Was the lean back and smile guy. Yeah.
Creepy.
We talked about it where the young reporter says at this youth center where they discussed the abuse crisis in America. And then Greg Brooks says, we're not going to talk about that. And then Shikluna said, what do you say? Oh, like, give the Pope time.
Yeah, that's right.
Drop the mic, lean back, smile like an Italian Don.
Yeah, he did. Like Skeletor. I guess he wasn't laughing. He was just smiling. So no Skeletor.
Yeah.
But.
And Shikluna was also sent by Francis to Chile to investigate the enormous debacle of Bishop Barros and the abuse cover-up scandal in Chile. So Shikluna is becoming a key man in Rome. And I suspect that Shikluna will be elevated to the C9, the Cardinal 9 group of Pope Francis, because one guy has recently gone off because of scandal. There's other people. I could see Supich being placed on the C9 as well, maybe next year.
There are no Americans on the C9 as of now.
That's correct. Wait. Yeah, I think that's right.
Need an American. I can see Supich.
Supich would be the guy. So
Shikluna's new blood, right? So I would guess if we were taking wagers, I would say Supich would come up next year.
Yeah.
So much happens in a year.
Which would be the argument that Supich gets cherry picked out of America and brought to Rome safely so that he can no longer be wrapped up in any American scandals and he has freedom and power in America. I mean, sorry, in Rome.
In Rome. Yeah.
So
the world at large.
Yep. Yep. So there it is. We'll wait and see. We'll come back in February and we'll talk. I mean, we'll have many videos before then, but we'll come back in February when this meeting's going down. And I can pretty much promise all the listeners that what we've predicted is going to happen. It's going to be all about let's protect the kids. There'll be no talk about homosexuality in the seminaries, in the priesthood, or any of the things we've seen in America, which is rectors and professors and priests and monsignors harassing and having intercourse with young priests, seminarians, and teenage boys. That will not be discussed. It'll be all about protecting young children, which we all can agree about. Rah, rah, rah. It's non-threatening. And then there will be no measures taken. Nothing canonical. No new policies. And it will be, let's move forward for the sake of unity.
Yeah, Supich is the one on the note you just mentioned. He said, we do explicitly, he openly owned it. We have to distinguish between the kinds of abuse happening with adults and kids. I forgot about that when we were talking.
I forgot about that too. But at USCCB meeting, he says, hey, we have to make a distinction that some of our priests are having sexual relationships with adult men. And that's different. And we need to he's trying to make room for that not being, in my eyes, a punishable offense.
Yes.
So that's also on the agenda, folks. So, all right, if you enjoy these videos, please hit the like button and subscribe and hit the little bell. When you hit the bell, that notifies you when we have new videos coming out. I'd also encourage people to check out Timothy's book, Catholic Republic, which discusses some of the things we talked about integralism, the Republic, and just the way Americans understand Catholicism, Christianity, and conservatism on a political level. And until next time, God bless. Godspeed. Keep praying that rosary.
Also, hey, could follow me on Twitter. I just opened up my Twitter account again.
Timothy is on Twitter.
It's at Timotheology. It's TimotheOlogy. I just opened that back up for the first time in 3 years.
So. I will add that to the show notes down below. You can follow me. I'm Taylor R. Marshall on Twitter. And you are, say it again.
Timotheology.
Timotheology.
Ology. Yeah.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Excellent. Also, I'd like to mention as well, Catholic Life Prep, which is the new St. Thomas Institute program for young adults ages 14 to 24. That's where we're losing most of our Catholic young adults. We have CatholicLifePrep.com. It's a curriculum for Catholic young people, how to answer their professors, their peers on the most common objections to Catholicism. It's a training course. It's going to be huge and important. So check that out, CatholicLifePrep.com or NewSt.Thomas.com. All right, now we can sign off, Tim. Ready? Adios. Godspeed.